David Mitchell Jr.
Oliver LeBanks.
Gary Pierre.
Larry Ransons.
Larry Matthews.
Joseph Brown.
Michael Barnett.
Alonzo Hogan.
Mitchell Johnson.
Anoka Jones.
Leon Lorette.
Angel Mejia.
Kenneth Randolph.
Manuel Reed.
Michael Vincent.
Dottrell Woods.
August Watkins.
Nicholas Pellegrin.
Kurt Cunningham.
Wayne Smith.
Chris DeVille.
Bruce Williams.
Christopher Sattelfield.
That's 23 names. 23 victims of a serial killer who operated in New Orleans and the Houma, Louisiana area from 1997 to 2006.
We're going to refer to this killer as R.D. because we marginalize the offender, not the victims.
We want to make sure that we focus on the victims and give them a voice and ensure that their names are remembered rather than that of the killer. And most of these cases, people don't realize the amount of victims that were killed, but also have never heard their names.
Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler. And with me is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, formerly of New Scotland Yard, an advocate and founder and director of Paladin, the National Stalking Advocacy Service, and also co-creator and producer of the case of JonBenet Ramsey.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague, and I have a real interest in real crime and these minds that solve those crimes. Laura, we miss you. Laura is still Skyping in from the UK. Do you want to share what you've been up to since you've been away? It's been so long.
Yeah, it certainly does feel like a long time, and it's been pretty gray and rainy over here.
Same thing here, Laura. It's been pretty gray and rainy here as well.
Oh, so there hasn't been the sunshine. I've been wondering whether the sun's been out and it's just been in London. It's been cold and rainy.
We've gotten more rain in the last 2 months than we had in the previous 5 years. We're already more than 3 inches above our annual rainfall in the first month.
Well, I hope that changes when I come out next week because I'm looking for some rays of sunshine. But certainly there have been a few over here, and one of Paladin's campaigns working with our ambassador achieved success actually on January the 6th, where the government did a U-turn and they agreed that the sentences for stalkers would be increased to 10 years, which is fantastic news. And I was also over in Northern Ireland too, where actually one of the police officers over there, as I went through Stormont Security, which is their parliament, to talk about domestic violence, coercive control, and the new bringing in a new law on stalking. And one of the officers came up to me and asked if I was Laura Richards and am I from Real Crime Profile? And I was absolutely astounded that when I said yes, he was so excited to see me. And so he couldn't believe that I was stood in front of him and that he'd been listening to the podcast.
Isn't that wonderful? Oh, that's fantastic.
That's great.
It was. So
they're out
shout
there.
Shout out to him, to James, if you're listening. It was great to meet you.
This is a particularly gruesome series that we're about to launch off into a whole series of murders that occurred around New Orleans, Louisiana, in some small parishes, some small parishes around New Orleans, and it's a really troubling case. And when we'll get into the weeds on it, but the fact is that this case went on far longer than it should have, and I believe that at least part of that was because of the population that was targeted as victims in this case. So why don't we start out with the very first victim. David Mitchell Jr. was a 19-year-old, and he typically hitchhiked. He was not very well off, and didn't have the means to get around or do much, so he got around by hitchhiking. And he's believed to be the first victim found in St. Charles Parish, and that was back in 1997. So right after JonBenet's murder, and yet nobody around the world knows his name. Everybody knows JonBenet Ramsey, but they don't know David Mitchell Jr.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, the other case at this time as well, or just before, was obviously Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman. And you would think that everyone would know their names too, but not necessarily, as that case got translated to the case of O.J. Simpson. But this case, as you said, Jim C., has certainly all the hallmarks where most of the victims actually, people don't know their names. And when I put it out on Twitter, it was only one person who had said that they'd done some research so they knew which case this was. So I think that is staggering. And of course, we don't know whether truly he was the first victim either.
Right.
With the weather conditions and hurricanes, right, and so on and so forth, that it's very difficult to tell if this really was the first victim in the series.
Yeah, one of the difficult things for law enforcement in this area is that it is filled with bayous and swamps and very secluded areas that unfortunately will swallow up a victim pretty quickly. And on top of that, the weather, the heat, the humidity, it all causes decomposition to accelerate. So we don't know actually if this killer started in 1997 or if he had had victims prior to that that we just haven't found yet. But the important point to remember is that these people who were killed were from poor communities in general, and they were mostly non-white. And this happens to be at the high point. We've talked a little bit about New Orleans and the issues with law enforcement at the time. And this happened to be around the high point of the problems with the New Orleans area police departments. There was a lot of corruption going on, not much funding. In fact, it even got worse after Katrina came, and many of the law enforcement jurisdictions in the area lost all of the evidence that they had on any cases during Hurricane Katrina because their offices simply flooded out or were destroyed in the process. I know at the time when Katrina hit, the FBI's brand new office was actually on a pretty low-lying area, and they, all the agents were called in, and they literally carried all the files from the first and second floor up to the third floor to try to save them from the rushing in water. And many of the police departments didn't have that ability.
Right.
So they lost a lot of their files. And as we'll see as we go down the road in this case, the killer decided to move his operation as a result of Katrina. Maybe because he got washed out, or maybe because his victims moved away and he followed his victims to another town.
Can you guys talk about how David Mitchell was found and you know, what was significant about the way he was killed and the things that they learned about him?
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, David Mitchell was found in sort of a gully. He's found, you know, with his pants down around his ankles, and the police just made the assumption, oh, that guy probably was drunk, went to take a leak, fell and drowned. The problem is, he was asphyxiated, but he didn't have any water in his lungs. He did not drown, and they didn't take it seriously. Right then and there, they should have known that this was a dangerous killer, and I think they just brushed David Mitchell under the rug because they didn't really care. He was African-American, he was poor, and they thought he was just some alcohol-ridden drunk who fell and accidentally killed himself.
And normally in a case like this, they would ask all the relatives, they would try to find out, you know, if anybody, when they had last seen him, who he knew, you know, what would be the process in a normal, if this were a different kind of a victim?
Well, I mean, we would launch into victimology, right, Laura?
Absolutely. The victimology is absolutely key. And, you know, you would expect for a full-on investigation and for the forensics to be done that, you know, you would want to ensure that an open mind was the starting point, but certainly timelining the victim, where they were the night before or who saw them, the sequence of events and their last footsteps. And, you know, we've seen it in a number of cases where those things aren't done because assumptions are made. And sometimes it's just the principle of least effort, looking for the easy out. And it would appear with this case that that's exactly what happened. So, not, this wasn't the first time. This would continue for, sadly, another 8 years.
Right. And so let's talk about that a little bit, Laura. First of all, the fact that this victim was found with his pants down around his ankles, discarded in a gutter without, you know, just like a swampy gutter. It didn't really have much water in it. But yet they said the cause of death was asphyxia due to drowning. I mean, clearly they didn't give a damn about the forensic evidence, did they?
Well, it certainly looks that way in terms of, you know, just hoping or just making the assumption that, you know, maybe he's gone to the toilet and he's fallen in the water. You know, they've jumped to many conclusions. But I think, you know, as more bodies turn up, and certainly as those bodies turn up in some of the similar locations close to each other, 100 feet apart, over time, and the similarities between the victim type, which of course should be ringing alarm bells, are the things that a blind eye is being turned to. And, you know, we don't know for what reason exactly. We've certainly listened to some of the officers talk, you know, on various TV shows, which is interesting in and of itself, of what they say. But I think, you know, many of these young men, and I think the average age was about 25, and there were 18 black men and 5 white men. And these are the ones that we know about. Alarm bells were not ringing for a very long time.
Right. And so, but the actual circumstances that the victim was found in, with his pants down around his ankles and discarded in this, like, trash, in this gutter, in this gully, it shows a marked disrespect on the part of the offender towards this victim. And what I find very illuminating in this case is that the killer clearly disrespected the victim. And unfortunately, given what actually went on and how long it took for law enforcement to appropriately respond to this, it seemed like that same disrespect was mirrored in the law enforcement officers investigating these cases. And unfortunately, that allowed more and more and more victims to pile up in this case.
Absolutely. I think that's right. That, you know, I think someone likened it to, I was listening to a number of the interviews by various police officers and locals saying, you know, it was almost like someone just taking out the trash, you know, as if the men that were killed, you know, the concept of the less dead, that they're not going to be missed, or, you know, there's a huge mark of disrespect from the killer himself, of discarding. And the more, you know, the years roll by, the more prolific he becomes, and the more emboldened of just leaving the bodies by the roadside. But of course, we know one of them in particular was also found in a trash can in a dumpster, which also speaks volumes in terms of behavior and what that tells us.
Yeah. And that brings us to the next victim, which is Oliver LeBanks. And although David Mitchell Jr. was 19, Oliver LeBanks was 27 years old, and it was a year later, 98. And he was found under one of the overpasses from a highway, and he had bruising to his neck. He was in Jefferson Parish in the French Quarter. But they categorized him as a male sex worker, and I think this is an important topic to discuss for a little bit. A male sex worker. You know, we do the same thing to women who are in the profession of...
In the sex trade, yeah.
Sex trade, yeah. And it's as if those words, you know, sex worker, quantify their entire life.
Right.
And what does that actually indicate? Does it indicate someone who is so destitute that they are left with selling one of two things, drugs or their bodies, to survive? And I think this happens with men, it happens with women, it happens with children, boys and girls, teens on either side, and many people take advantage of them by paying them for sex. But I really bristle at the fact that we can sort of sum them up by one word saying prostitute, whether they're male or female. And I think that it doesn't accurately describe who they are as a human being. It doesn't actually tell us what their story is. And it certainly doesn't make them deserve to be killed in such a horrific manner.
And when the police say that to the media, when they're reporting on this person's death, and that's like one of the only identifiers of this person, it almost just psychologically pushes them into the margins in the public's mind. Like, well, they had it coming. They deserved it, or that's what you get. I mean, it's really, really damaging.
But, you know, we do know that obviously they're higher risk in terms of them being sex workers or, you know, with drug or alcohol abuse or misuse. It's higher risk behavior. But of course, it's no reason to blame someone and to sort of almost eliminate the perpetrator and their choices and their predatory behavior. But it's certainly something that I think, you know, being young black males and having in their backgrounds being transient and, you know, more high risk, then people seem to think that they're less worthy, even as a victim in their own murders, which is the thing, obviously, we feel strongly about correcting.
Well, and this is another thing. What would turn out would be the fact that despite the condition of David Mitchell Jr. and Oliver LeBanks, the police departments did not do rape kits on them. They did not actually investigate this as a sexual crime, even though they knew that Oliver LeBanks actually was forced into a situation where he was making money by selling himself sexually. And so the fact is they probably could have gotten DNA of the killer at that point, but didn't bother doing that kind of an investigation.
And that actually might have caught him sooner because R.D., he had been arrested for rape before.
Yes.
So they had his DNA. You know, they had it. So they could have connected it a lot sooner.
Absolutely. Yeah. And since you brought up that case, it's a good time to talk about it. The fact is that he was arrested for aggravated rape against a male, and he was brought in, arrested. I'm sure he was... His DNA was collected. He was charged, but the victim did not want to go on and testify, which obviously we know in most rape cases with females, there is a very high percentage, an extremely high percentage. The vast majority of victims do not want to report it to law enforcement. There's been studies that show it's as high as 80 to 85% of the victims, adult female victims of rape, do not report to law enforcement.
Jesus.
I believe that number is astronomically higher for men who are victims of rape because there are additional negative stereotypes, negative myths, and negative feelings about men who are raped. And so I think that really reduces the number of people who report it. And certainly, even as this case shows, in cases where they do report, they don't necessarily want to follow through. So RD was released. He was not prosecuted for this aggravated rape case, and he was out and free to kill again.
He did spend a little bit of time in prison, and you know that was something that also shaped what he went on to do, because he was determined that he would never go back. And you know, there's a lot to be said that in cases where it's deemed, you know, there's insufficient evidence, that had they have done the things that that could have been done to build the case in a different way, which we do with murder victims when there's no victim there to give evidence, then of course this would have been solved, and he would have been stopped almost in his tracks. And the reason why, or he gives a version of events that why he went on and escalated his behavior from rape to murder was so that dead men can't talk. And that's the rationale for the escalation. But there are always what I call near misses and missed opportunities. And unfortunately, this case has so many peppered in amongst the almost 10 years that he was allowed to escalate and kill so many vulnerable men.
Exactly. And when we come back, we will go on to victim number 3, Gary Pierre. Back talking about victim number 3 in New Orleans, Gary Pierre. He was a 20-year-old from St. Charles Parish, and he was actually killed in 1997. They did not find his body right away, and that goes back to what we were saying earlier about the fact that New Orleans and the parishes surrounding New Orleans are filled with swamps and bayous and thickets that can easily hide a body. And because of the weather, the heat, and the humidity, it's very, very easy for decomposition to set in right away and there to be little or nothing left for law enforcement to find.
And they're also so desolate. I mean, you can spend a lot of time out there and not come across another living person. And yeah. I think that helps, you know, that must have aided in their dumping ground.
Yeah, and I also believe there's a lot of gators around there and other critters that can dispose of a body for these offenders. So, but what's important is that, again, in this case, the victim was found discarded. No attempt to really hide the victim other than putting them in an area that was out of the direct path, but very easy to be discovered. So Gary was 20 years old. Again, sort of a young man who found himself in circumstances where he was not very well off, and he became the victim because the offender most likely approached him with some sort of proposition where he could either get money from selling drugs or selling himself, or he would also, do other things to lure victims in. We will find out more and more, and we'll focus on the offender later on, but we'll find out more and more about how he evolved. As Laura said, part of that evolution came from his experiences in prison, and part of it came from probably successes and failures outside of prison while he was offending.
And, he also did use a con approach, didn't he, as a ruse, and he would target young black men in particular who looked a certain way, and he would offer them things and he would work out quickly their vulnerabilities and try and exploit that, whether it was him offering sex or whether it was drugs or offering to have sex with a woman. And I think, that's the other part to this. He isn't just going up to them and hitting them over the head and putting them into a vehicle. He's actually talking with them beforehand, engaging them. And these were young men who were, relatively streetwise too. They were used to living. Some of them were transient. Some of them were, still living with their families, but they weren't in the main naive in that sense. But he was trying to entice them into his car, and he would take them, some of them, to another trailer that he had that was a very isolated place. And then he would discard their bodies afterwards.
Right. And that brings us to Larry Ransom's body. And that was found late in 1998. And his body was located 100 feet from where David Mitchell Jr. was found. And that, remember, was the first victim, 19 years old, and in much the same condition. And yet, they did not raise the alarm. They did not tell the community that there was a dangerous serial killer operating, killing young men, brutally killing them. And yet,
well, that's my question.
They had
you.
Everything. Yeah. They had all the information they needed to know.
In your guys' experience, at what point is it considered a serial crime? Can you define yeah. what that is, at least from the FBI point
yeah.
of view?
Yeah, serial murder is defined by the Behavioral Analysis Unit at the FBI as two or more killings in separate events. Serial killing is defined by Congress, and that's just for the purposes of giving FBI primary jurisdiction, as three or more murders in separate incidents. If the FBI had been notified at this point that there were, up to this point, four victims, two of them found within 100 feet of each other in similar circumstances, and that these were all young African-American men, some of them who were gay, some of them who were sex workers, we would have certainly investigated it as a serial killer case. However, that notification was not made to the FBI. They were kept as local, small investigations, if there was any investigation at all.
So, Laura, is there a different definition for a serial killer in the UK?
Well, we actually set up a group, a homicide prevention unit group, that was one on serial killers, and we did use the FBI's originally three. And then we changed it to two, or it could be one or a near miss, but you'd have to, we'd take those cases on a case by case basis. So, but they'd have to be separate events as Jim described. Certainly in this case where, you know, a body's turned up in exactly the same place and, detectives, I mean, I saw some of the video footage of it, are stood, at David Mitchell's deposition site, and they can, in their eye line, literally yards away, was where the other body deposition site was. So once you have that, and given the victimology, you know, it's just, for me, you know, unbelievable that the police aren't linking this, but the journalists and the media are. And there was one particular journalist who was asking the right questions about these cases being connected in 1998. And it seems that nobody else was at this time. But we'll talk about the media as well, because they play an interesting role.
Yeah, actually, and this is one time in which the media is trying to push law enforcement to do their job to protect the community. But I really think that these were marginalized members of the community for a number of reasons. They were poor. They were black. Some of them may have been gay. Some of them may have been sex workers. And for all those reasons compounded, I think the police, who were generally not any of those things, were just treating them as trash taken out. And it's just really unfortunate.
I think the journalist who was asking the right questions was a local journalist, and he actually called up the New York Times and was talking to them about, you know, what was going on locally. And again, there was still no interest at all, even when the body count continued into double figures. So, you know, not just sort of local media, it's national and international media, and picking and choosing which cases they cover.
And something I notice is, if, you know, if this had been happening in West Hollywood or in the Castro in San Francisco, I mean, after you get to three victims, there would have been such an outcry, and the media, the national media, damn well would have picked it up. And so that's so infuriating. It must feel so bad for the victims' families that nobody was noticing them at all.
Nobody cared. Nobody cared, especially the people who were supposed to be investigating the cases. They certainly didn't evince any kind of real concern about this at this point, and we'll see as we go on down this list. The next victim discovered was Larry Matthews, and you know what? We have almost no information about him.
Yeah, I mean, when I was preparing for this podcast, I was trying to look up everybody, and of course, you can get all the information you want about the serial killer himself, what he ate for breakfast, basically, you know, and you can't even find an obituary for some of these guys. And, you know, fortunately, there is that documentary that I mentioned earlier, Bayou Blue, Mystery of the Bayou Blue Serial Killer, and they do interview some of the family members. And I have found little blips and blurbs of news footage, you know, here and there. But so many people just have nobody speaking out for them.
And you can also watch Lifetime Movie Network, the show Killer Profile that Laura and I did with Jim, our colleague Jim Fitzgerald. And we cover this particular case and a couple of other cases that were also going on at that time. So you'll get a lot more detail there. But Larry Matthews, being the sixth victim discovered, really has lost almost all existence. I mean, nobody knows anything about him. There's nothing, there's no record of him as a human being or what his life was like or his family. And
there is a small thumbnail picture of all of these victims, but it's so hard to even see their names. It's a board that I guess the police finally put up, you know, with all of the victims. But it's just really sad.
Yeah. One thing that I noticed, victim six, actually, Joseph Brown, was only 16 years old. And to call him a sex worker, it's just not fair. I mean, the fact is that a 16-year-old is a child under the law, and if he was being paid for sex, he was being sexually victimized. And it doesn't matter. The law protects him, and to classify him as a sex worker, I just think is wrong. It should not be done. It should be that he was victimized by Johns, who paid him for sex. And I just think that's an important point to make.
Well, a child can't make that decision, you know, and I think that's the point. And now we say that a lot, you know, we're not talking about prostitution. Children cannot give consent. So it's child abuse.
And he was, quote, discarded on the side of the road. Again, this whole trash reference, this whole, you know, disrespect and victim minimizing happens in the reports and obviously with the investigators, because nothing really has been done and no kind of relevant effort has been made. And there's very little information about what actually happened to this victim.
Well, the other thing is, you know, in these different parishes, you know, for the police, they don't seem to be talking to each other either and sharing information. And you know, I know this area is certainly big and vast and isolated, but just young black men who are dead, turning up on the side of the road, not being hidden, no criminal sophistication. I mean, it really, you know, I wrote down, you know, where is the intelligence-led policing here? Because there seems to be, you know, the fact that people, or maybe law enforcement at that time, thinking as well that, you know, serial killers don't work, or maybe they think that they do work to police artificial boundaries, and, you know, the lack of communication and the lack of outrage, the local community too, and the families, you know, maybe they couldn't get the attention placed on their loved ones for those who did turn up. But I know certainly in some of the press conferences, the families weren't even allowed into the building. So I guess they really didn't have a voice when their loved one went missing, and more so when they turned up dead in suspicious circumstances. I just can't even imagine how that must feel for these families.
I wanted to ask a question. I mean, it must be hard as law enforcement. You are trying to put together these clues and draw parallels. You know, what are the similarities between these victims? And so you are starting this laundry list of young, black, gay, or, you know, prostitute boys. And you're starting to put them in a group to try to solve the problem, to find the murderer. But then again, that laundry list has unintended consequences, because I have an article here from a Houma gay bar owner who himself is former law enforcement. He's a retired Lafayette Police Department detective, and even he says that the gay community didn't really identify with these boys because, in his words, I never heard anyone say they were worried about becoming a victim. those victims tended to be people who lived on the fringe. They were the kind of people who were willing to do anything for a dollar. So this is even in the gay community, they're kind of discriminating against these victims themselves, and nobody is worried. And if and you guys are going to explain that this killer did go on to evolve to other victims. And yeah. And
yeah, the thing is that, you know, it's almost like a caste system, because these guys were poor, because these guys were African-American, because these guys maybe made a living, some of them, selling drugs or selling themselves, they were not considered really part of the community. And unfortunately, it made them more vulnerable. And there was no community outrage that at this point we're already up to six victims, and they're in neighboring parishes. And so it's a real problem. Okay, so when we come back from the break, we'll talk about Manuel Reed, a 20-year-old who was found in a dumpster. Well, now that we're back, we're talking about Manuel Reed. He was a 20-year-old male, African-American, who was found in a dumpster in May of 1999. This was in Jefferson Parish, but he was different from other victims for some reason, and he was literally dumped into a dumpster like trash, not covered up, not wrapped in plastic, but literally just discarded. And of course, he was discovered. His body was discovered when somebody else tried to put trash or look for something in the dumpster. In my mind, there's probably something significant about this victim, probably something in their interaction. Maybe he fought back. Maybe he was very difficult to deal with. Maybe whatever he did to this victim didn't go as well as he wanted to, and it probably really pissed him off. I think there's something about this that, you know, could have been out of convenience as well. This victim may have been killed in a place other than where he normally killed victims, or he may have had some kind of close call and wanted to get rid of the body. What we find, right, Laura, in cases where, you know, people kill, especially serial killers, we typically find that they will try to distance themselves from the victims as quickly as possible. And that's why you have sort of this discarding of victims rather than spending any time in permanent concealment. And so when an offender typically tries to, like, say, bury a victim, for example, takes the time with the body to dig a hole and cover it up and make sure it doesn't get found, that's typically because there's some way that that victim can be linked to this offender. And because he's not even bothering with that in this case, it's a very strong likelihood that none of these victims are actually known to the offender, or nobody knows of the relationship between the offender and these victims. It's just one more point in the profile that we're building.
Well, I think, you know, it is certainly significant that he's found in the trash can, but of course we don't know whether there were other bodies that were never found post, you know, Hurricane Katrina. You know, normally in cases, as you said, Jim, it could be one of many things, or in fact all of those things. You know, it could be the way that he responded, it could be something that was significant to do with the way that he acted that reminded him of a previous experience. It, you know, could be about convenience, but one thing's for sure, it's a horrific way to end up. I mean, he was 20 years old, so just really starting out on in life, and to be found, you know, in the rubbish, it really is that whole sense of just discarding and putting out the rubbish and or the trash, which is just horrific. And, you know, of course, he continued on. This was really just the start of it all.
Right. And his next victim was from St. Charles Parish, Alonzo Hogan. And there really isn't a lot of information out there about him, is there?
Well, he was 34. And I read some accounts from his sister, actually, Cynthia Zamora, and as it turns out, he was with someone at this time, and she was pregnant. And he left his sister's house on Friday, July the 1st, 2005, on his bike, and he'd been washing his bike that afternoon, and he was waiting for his brother-in-law to return home because they were going to go fishing together. And apparently that, you know, he led a relatively simple life. He loved going out on his bike and he loved going fishing. But he had a daughter who he never got to meet, which is incredibly sad. Her name's Angel. And at the time the sister Cynthia spoke, Angel was 5, but she now would be 12 years old. And, you know, unfortunately, Alonso, having gone out on his bike, never returned home for that fishing trip. And he turned up dead the next day by the side of a highway.
So does this, like, raise any flags to law enforcement as far as he's not fitting the mold of the other victims now, right? I mean, what do they do with that? Or do they even notice it? Or, you know, because they still continue to talk about these victims as being transients and drug users, and, you know, they continue to lump them all together.
Right, and they probably didn't. They lumped them all together as high-risk victims, but they didn't lump them all together as the victims of a serial killer. They didn't actually do anything to sort of do a comprehensive effort at linking them forensically or linking them behaviorally or literally linking the local parishes together in a solidified fight to find this offender.
So, well,
and I think we, when we come back for the next segment, talking about this case, we will get into a little bit more about the offender's MO and how he was able to get all these relatively fit and strong young men into a vulnerable position. This would be the offender's most sort of telling MO aspect, because it really revealed a lot about his true psychology and also his devious intent and how manipulative he was. So I just want to let all our Real Crime Profile listeners know that my next episode of Criminal Minds that I wrote, it's called A Good Husband, will be premiering on Wednesday night at 9 on CBS.
Yeah.
So it's a very relevant episode related to the topics that we talk about, right, Laura?
It certainly is, and I'm really looking forward to, I saw some of it being filmed, but I'm really looking forward to seeing it. It's all about coercive control, and Jim's really pioneered here of getting it onto the Criminal Minds show and onto the mass market.
Yeah, and I certainly relied on Laura's work and research and input about coercive control and about how we need to get that made into a crime here in the United States, and they've definitely pushed the needle in the right direction in the UK, where it is already a crime, and you've made tremendous strides in terms of sentencing and so forth in those areas. Whereas in the United States, although we kind of led the world in stalking legislation, we haven't yet gotten to the point where we are actually addressing coercive control as a form of domestic violence.
And one thing, I'm not going to spoil your episode at all, but the way that you depict it in this story is very different. And I think it's what I love about it is that people who don't necessarily recognize they're in a coercive control situation may all of a sudden, the light bulb may go off by watching your episode. There are some very specific things that you do that I'm just so proud of you for doing it. And, you know,
well, I'm really excited about it, and I know the executives at CBS were also very happy to do it. It was an opportunity to, in a setting that you might not expect, discuss the issues that come up in marriages and in situations between friends, and how you can recognize it, how friends can recognize it, how friends can maybe help out. And how dangerous it is if it's left unchecked.
It correlates to lethality and to homicide, and that's the thing. It's the most predictive and strongest correlator in terms of risk factors. And as you quite rightly said, so many people don't recognize it or identify it because some of the behaviors can be very subtle and they can be very nuanced and they can look like very attentive behaviors, but it's the pattern, and it's being characterized very true to life. And well done, Jim C. And Criminal Minds for doing this. I am really excited and so pleased.
Thank you. And thank you for your help and all the work you do in the real world on this.
Well, there's so much more to this case that I want to talk about with you, Jim and Laura, and it's going to lead us into even more discussions of other serial killers and other victim pools in Louisiana. So stay tuned, you guys, for the next segment of The Killing Bayous.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone, 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214 946 4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.